morning and welcome to the 11th Circuit. And this, our third day of sitting in Atlanta. We welcome you. A couple things before we get started. One is, for those of you who are not familiar with our timing clock, it's like a traffic light system. When the light turns yellow, that's a warning. It means you have 2 minutes left in your argument time. And then when the light turns red, we ask that you conclude your sentence. Quickly conclude, that means stop. And if you're answering the court's questions, of course you may finish your answer. And if we take you over your time, then that's at the court's expense if we're asking you questions. The second thing is, please know that we are familiar with your cases. We've read the briefs and we've looked at the relevant parts of the record. And so you can feel free to go right into the heart of your argument. Okay, so our first case of the morning is number 20-12281, Casa versus Stevenson. Mr. Smith?
May it please the court, good morning, Your Honors. My name is Wingo Smith, and along with my co-counsel, Jeff Filipovitz and Tiffany Roberts, I represent the appellant, Mr. Kinemariam Casa. Your Honors, absolute immunity is justified and defined by the functions it protects. At issue here is whether the district attorney's failure to inform the court that issued a material witness warrant after Casa appeared and testified at trial, and after the conclusion of that criminal trial, whether that was a function of her role as an advocate for the state or an administrative function. Mr. Casa urges this court to follow the Third Circuit's decisions in Odd v. Malone and Schneider v. Smith and overturn the district court's decision to grant absolute immunity to ADA Stevenson. The functions of an advocate require that there be a case in which you're advocating and that you were exercising professional judgment or prosecutorial discretion. Both of those issues are absent in this case. In addition, we see that the courts have applied that absolute immunity is undergirded by a public policy that looks to protect the judicial process, not the prosecutor herself. Thus, the function must be intimately associated with the judicial phase of the criminal process and one in which the threat of litigation or vexus litigation would interfere with the exercise of that prosecutorial discretion.
I know we've held that the actions to help enforce a sentence that are taken after a trial fall within the absolute immunity bucket. Is there anything else you think that could happen after a trial, or is that generally the stopping point for absolute immunity in this context?
I think certain actions, as they would relate to an argument in the appellate process, may also be included along with the sentencing phase of a trial or in the enforcement of a sentence, as happened in Hart v. Hodges. But neither of those instances is relevant to Mr. Casa's case, who was an innocent third-party witness, not a criminal defendant, and whose role within the case had already ended by the time he appeared and testified, and furthermore, after the criminal trial itself had ended.
Let me ask you just to inform me what the process actually is. As I understand it, if a prosecutor wants to get a material witness warrant for someone whom she hopes to call at a trial, the prosecutor has to go to a judge, make a motion, and in writing get the judge to sign off on it, right?
That's my understanding. It's not pled in our complaint that way. We're at the motion to dismiss stage, so
no, but I'm just looking at what I can discern from the law of Georgia on the subject. So there's no question that when I go to the judge as a prosecutor and say, I want a warrant for this guy Marcus, I'm afraid he's not going to appear, the trial is in X day, the judge says okay and signs off. That's an act that would be intimately associated with the judicial process and with the prosecutor function and would yield absolute immunity, right?
We would agree with that, Your Honor.
trial occurs, witness testifies. How does the warrant get canceled?
That's where
under Georgia law, do I have to go back to the judge to seek the recall or vacator of the warrant?
To the best of my understanding, Your Honor, there is no provision within the statute that describes a process by which the material witness warrant is canceled. By and again, as it's pled in our pleadings, that is, at this stage, it was said that it was either the prosecuting attorney's duty or the investigator's duty as the complainant, as the person who provided the facts, that they were required to go back to the issuing judge, and ask that it be canceled.
Understanding of the law is the prosecutor's got to go back to the judge, either that judge or a judge of similar jurisdictional power, a general jurisdiction judge, and say, I want to vacate the warrant. I want to recall the warrant, and the judge has to sign that just like he signed the flip side of the coin, right?
Our understanding is that it's by custom and practice that this occurs, not necessarily that it's within the law itself. And in this case, it could have been anyone, as we understand it, that could have gone back and told the judge that he had appeared and that the trial was over, letting the judge know.
That's really the heart of my question. Could a case agent go back to the court and make a motion to vacate or recall the warrant?
There's nothing in the law.
Or is this the kind of thing that the prosecutor would have to do?
And I apologize for cutting in there. No. There's nothing in the law that would require the prosecutor to be the person taking up that function.
Suppose the law had said specifically, instead of it being custom and usage, it said upon performance by the witness, an application or motion must be made to the trial judge to vacate or recall the warrant. Doesn't say who does it. Would that not suggest that the function itself remains basically the same? What I'm really trying to get at, is this the flip side of the same coin, and are we slicing the salami too finely to say, heads, you get absolute immunity when you seek the warrant, because that's plainly bullseye within the role of a prosecutor, but tails, you lose the absolute immunity when you seek to vacate or recall the warrant from the same judge, and it's part and parcel with the same judicial process. Why is one act absolutely immune and the other act devoid of immunity? That's what I'd like you to help me with.
I think there are two issues that would help bring some clarity to that. The first is that, again, as the courts have said, that professional judgment or advocacy is required as part of the advocacy function. And in dismissing a material witness warrant, there's no advocacy to be had at that point. It's a merely administrative act. We see that in Kalina, where we distinguish between a prosecutor and a complaining witness, that all you have to do is aver to the facts. Versus having to make a motion or argue before the court or present testimony to the court. We see that as well in Simon v. City of New York out of the Second Circuit, which dealt with a prosecuting attorney who used a material witness warrant to conduct an extrajudicial investigatory interview of a material witness rather than following the law and having them go to the court first. And we see it in Odd v. Malone, which held that at that point in which the trial had actually been dismissed, there was no more advocacy to be had within the context of the trial as it related to that witness because he had no testimony to provide. And so that's we think that these are factors in which should be counted here in looking at whether or not this would be an advocacy function. So we have the fact that there's no more criminal case. There's nothing less to advocate on behalf of the state for within the criminal case.
Suppose what happened in a case was the material witness warrant was obtained from the court, the witness appeared, the witness testified, the witness was still in jail, And the trial was a lengthy white-collar crime, and it would take 4 weeks to try, and the prosecutor does not seek the vacator of the warrant as soon as the witness testifies on the theory that maybe he'll want him for rebuttal 4 weeks later. At that point, would that still be within the ken of professional judgment?
I think that gets to be a much closer question, but one that was answered in Schneider v. Smith. In that case, a slightly longer period of time, the court had, the criminal trial had been continued for 3 months, and the prosecuting attorney allowed the material witness to be incarcerated during that time and failed to inform the court that, in fact, because the judge who issued it in that case, as in this case, was not the trial court. And it failed to inform the court that he remained, or she remained, pardon me, incarcerated during that lengthy break. And the court there found that the duty to inform the court was, again, administrative, regardless of the fact that there was still a criminal trial to be had a few months later.
I've got a question in a different direction. I want to make sure I get to ask you. Should we decide, let's say that we agree with you that absolute immunity does not apply. Should we consider whether Stevenson had qualified immunity?
For two reasons we would say no. First, it was not briefed, as it related to ADA Stevenson, it was not briefed at the trial court, nor was it a part of the trial court's decision.
So would you say that she's waived or forfeited that argument?
For the purposes of this hearing, yes, Your Honor. I think that on remand, it would be possible for ADA Stevenson to reassert, assert for the first time to the trial court that she's that she's allowed to have qualified immunity.
Let me just ask you a follow-up to the question Judge Grant asked. Turning away from qualified immunity for a moment, and I know this was not really raised, but to the extent the charge here is that the prosecutor was negligent, would that state a claim for a Fourth Amendment violation or a due process violation?
I have two answers to that, I believe, Your Honor, which first is that no, and second is that's not the claim that we brought, that she was merely negligent. Negligence was the standard for the state law claim that we had against ADA Stevenson, but was not what was pled as it related to the 1983 matter. There we pled a claim under the Fourth and 14th Amendment that her failure to inform the court violated Mr. Costa's right to be free from unlawful detention. On unreasonable detention.
But did you allege in the complaint that the act was an intentional act rather than saying nothing about it? The rest of the complaint talks about it as negligent, and it seems to me for you to make a due process claim or for you to make a Fourth Amendment claim, you've got to show that the acts were more than simply negligent acts. The termination of the freedom of movement means intentionally seeking that. The Supreme Court said that. We've said it in different contexts. I'm just curious, if the claim here is negligence, they screwed up. They should have done what they didn't do. Could that state a claim under the Fourth Amendment or under the Due Process Clause?
I'm not sure that mere negligence would state a claim in the face of qualified immunity, Your Honor. However, construing the facts in favor of Mr. Casa, we don't believe that's what's been alleged. Moreover, it's not just intentionality. It can also be recklessness in this case. It's only the merely negligent that are protected, not the incompetent or willful violator. And so in this case, with the advent of discovery, we may be able to also figure out what it is that she knew at the time and what it was that she was thinking when she did not go back to the court and request that this be done. We'd also say that in this particular case, she was one of two people that had the full knowledge. When she took out the warrant in the first place, she understood that her intention was to have Mr. Casa arrested. There's no doubt that's what the intention behind the material witness warrant was. And when he appeared and testified, she was one of two people who knew at that point in time that there was a material witness warrant out for him, that she had, and that he had satisfied the warrant before it was executed. And so her failure to do the minimum, which was to inform the judge that he had in fact appeared and testified, or that the court had concluded its criminal process at that point, that failure seems intentional at that point. She's the person that knows this. She's the person who understands what the material witness warrant that she requested, what that's going to do. And so any time after that point, she knew that he was subject to arrest, even though there was no reason for his arrest and no authority under the under the law. I believe my time may be concluded, so I would like to sit down. Thank you.
Yes, we'll give you your full 3 minutes for rebuttal because you were answering our questions. Ms. Denmark.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'm Emily Denmark, and I'm here with Stephen Rosenberg. We're from the Fulton County Attorney's Office. Judge Marcus, to address some of your questions, there really is no statutory procedure either for obtaining a material witness warrant here in Georgia or for releasing it. The Fulton County DA's office relied on a group of statutes. It was OCGA 15-1-3, 17-4-42, 17-7-25, and 17-7-26. The process that the Fulton County DA's office used for obtaining and then recalling, or making sure that a material witness warrant was recalled, is explained more in the record. It's in the appellate appendix, and it's document 34-1. It's an affidavit from the sheriff's office, so I would direct the court's attention to that affidavit. But in general, you know, unlike in some state courts and under federal procedure, we don't have specific statutory procedures for material witness warrants. What typically happens is a prosecutor will make an oral motion to the judge to release the warrant. The judge will orally rule on that warrant, rule on that motion. Then the judge, himself or herself, will execute what's either called a warrant cancellation notice or an order. That is then e-filed and sent to the sheriff's office. The sheriff's office then goes into a criminal information system that's maintained for the entire state and releases the warrant. So again, it's not set out in statute or in rules, but that's the procedure that is typically followed.
Is there any advocacy involved in that process? Or would it be granted as a matter of course, the trial's over, so the witness is no longer needed?
Yes, ma'am, I believe you're correct. The advocacy would be determining when to seek the release of the warrant on the prosecutor's part, but once that motion has been made, I don't think there would be advocacy involved from then on, because then it shifts to the judge. It's strictly a judicial process, and then the sheriff's office kind of wraps it up and concludes it by removing the warrant from the system.
But why isn't that, you say the decision to make the motion, why isn't that merely ministerial if the trial is over and the witness is no longer needed?
If the trial is over, then the warrant should be released. I think that would be an administrative function. If the trial is not yet concluded, it would not be, that would be a matter of discretion and prosecutorial advocacy. For example, as Judge Marcus mentioned, if you've got a really long trial, and you don't want to release the warrant in case you want to recall them. Even if this was, however, if this can, seeking or ensuring that the material warrant was released, if that is termed as a specifically administrative task, I do think that the Supreme Court's decision in Vandekamp versus Goldstein provides a means for this court to determine that prosecutorial immunity, absolute immunity, does still apply. There, the DA's actions that were under attack were termed by the court to be administrative procedures. And the court said, Goldstein is cited in our brief, but it's 555 U.S. 335. The court there said prosecutors involved in such administrative tasks enjoy absolute immunity from the kind of legal claims at issue here.
Remind me what the specific task that they were discussing was.
Those involved, it was a challenge that the DA office supervisors had not adequately trained and supervised deputy DAs about providing impeachment-related information for defendants.
So that's, even though I guess you could turn that administrative, that seems much more like there are certain judgment calls involved in that, right?
Yes, Your Honor, I do think that's true. However, the court in Goldstein said, it kind of looked at three things. It said, you've got to have, even though these are administrative tasks, they require some legal knowledge and the exercise of, related discretion. And I think that also can apply to the process of obtaining and then the related process of ensuring the release of a material witness warrant. I mean, you've got to have legal knowledge in terms and prosecutorial advocacy involved in terms of when you're going to present this witness, when you're going to release the witness, and that involves some discretion.
But after, couldn't you have theoretically a statewide rule that after a trial, any material witness warrants are automatically revoked?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor.
Doesn't that suggest that there's not really judgment or prosecutorial decision-making involved?
I think if that rule existed, then perhaps. But here in Georgia, we don't have that.
Well, but don't you have a custom in Georgia that upon the completion of the trial, the material witness warrant should be released, vacated, whatever, before the judge who had signed the warrant to begin with?
Yes, sir. I believe it can be released by any judge from that court.
Does that application have to be made by a prosecutor, or can a case agent tell the judge to release it, ask the judge to release it?
It's not clear. I believe that the typical policy is that the prosecutor seeks it.
Because it's a judge that you're going to.
Yes, sir.
Well, but if the function upon the completion of the trial is purely ministerial, even if it's executed by the prosecutor, is there any professional judgment that goes into that decision making?
Once the trial is over, I don't believe that there would be. But I would also point to the Hart versus Hodges case that was mentioned earlier, I believe it was mentioned earlier, that the prosecutorial duties do extend beyond the close of trial. So I think there has to be some caution in saying you can't apply prosecutorial immunity after the trial is concluded.
Just on the singular decision of whether to vacate the warrant.
Yes, sir, Your Honor.
I guess that I'm confused. In this case, the petitioner is picked up substantially after the warrant is never, he's never actually served with a warrant. He testifies on his own steam. Trial ends, and then substantially after the completion of the trial, he's picked up on the warrant, which is still on the books, if you will.
Yes, sir.
Why would that sequence of events yield the conclusion that absolute immunity should protect the prosecutor long after the trial was over and there was no professional judgment involved in the determination about seeking the vacator or release?
Well, I believe, Your Honor, that I see what your question is, and I think in analyzing whether absolute immunity applies, you're not looking necessarily at what happened, but what should have happened. It's the Hart versus Hodges says the determination of absolute immunity depends on the nature of the function performed, not whether the prosecutor performed that function incorrectly.
No, I agree with that. We're not looking at the state of mind of the prosecutor, whether he was malevolent or just screwed up and made a mistake. We're looking at the activity itself. Generically, we're looking at the conduct. But that really is the heart of my question. If we're looking at the conduct surrounding the application to release or vacate the warrant after the trial is over, is there any professional judgment that would go into that? Or is that so purely ministerial that we'd be hard-pressed to take this notion of absolute immunity and apply it to that act?
I do believe it's administrative and pretty ministerial, but I think that Goldstein also provides the means to apply absolute immunity because it does allow for absolute immunity to apply to purely administrative tasks.
Right, but on what basis, right? As we discussed in that case, there was judgment and discretion involved in that task, even though it was characterized as administrative. Here, I'm not sure that we've heard what kind of judgment is required or what kind of discretion is required. It seems to be a pretty automatic process that should happen.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that it should be automatic when the trial is concluded. Until the trial is concluded, I do believe discretion and legal knowledge is involved on the part of the prosecutor.
But is the fact that legal knowledge or discretion is required at one stage of the process, does that mean that the prosecutorial role in that function continues even after that need for judgment has dissipated?
I believe that it should, Your Honor, and I believe that if you get to the point where it almost feels like it's not splitting hairs, because I understand that there is a difference in the actions that are being taken here, but I don't know how much you can separate seeking the release of the warrant if obtaining the warrant itself and sometimes releasing the warrant is entitled to absolute immunity.
Well, let's say that we decided that absolute immunity did not apply. Do you think that Stevenson has forfeited the argument of qualified immunity, either here or the district court?
Your Honor, I don't believe that it was sufficiently briefed in the district court. I do believe the court could find that she's entitled to qualified immunity, affirming a decision that's right for any reason, but it was not sufficiently briefed below.
If we didn't do that, do you think that she could raise that again to the district court, or do you think she's missed that chance?
No, I believe that she can. And going back to the law governing absolute immunity itself, I believe that the precedent states, you know, the presumption is that you have qualified immunity as a prosecutor, and the prosecutor then has the burden of proving that it's absolute. I do believe ADA Stevenson would be able to do that, not only that she can make the argument, but that she can make it successfully. In terms of the Odd case, Odd versus Malone, that Mr. Costa relies on, of course, this is an extrajudicial case. And furthermore, it was issued before the Goldstein decision was issued that ADA Stevenson relies on. And for that reason, we don't believe that Odd should be applied in this case. And also in Odd, it's distinguishable there because there were additional circumstances present evidencing the prosecutor's intent to violate the material witness's civil rights. In this case, we don't have any such allegations. And I'll also note that there haven't been any allegations that the failure to seek the release or the cancellation of the warrant here was anything other than oversight or a mistake.
So what's the tension or inconsistency between Goldstein and Odd that you're referring to?
Odd was decided before Goldstein, so it was before the Supreme Court kind of first said prosecutorial immunity can apply to administrative functions. And that's the case, that's the principle that ADA Stevenson is relying on heavily here, and the Third Circuit did not take into consideration that determination by the Supreme Court. Applying absolute prosecutorial immunity here is with regard to Stevenson's alleged failure to secure the release of the warrant. That comports with this court's earlier decision in Hart versus Hodges. This court found that absolute immunity did apply because the DA's actions were directly related to and intimately associated with the state trial court's sentence and his role as an advocate regarding the court's sentence. So the Hart reasoning applies to the instant case, particularly in light of Goldstein, because ADA Stevenson's actions were so closely tied to her advocative role as a prosecutor that she's entitled to prosecutorial immunity. So the role of obtaining this conviction against Mr. Casa's assailant, which in turn included securing Mr. Casa's testimony and ensuring the warrant was released, those should be protected under both Goldstein and Hart. I think there's no doubt that the circumstances of Mr. Casa's detention are disturbing and upsetting, but any alleged failure on the part of ADA Stevenson's part can only be categorized as oversight or negligence and not done with any intent or malice. And such negligence surely cannot support a claim under Section 1983.
Right, but we don't, that's why I raised the question with your colleague, but we don't have a decision by the district court or even an application in the district court to dismiss, not on the grounds of absolute immunity, but that the complaint fails to state a claim under 12b-6 because you would have to allege intentional conduct to support a claim under the Fourth Amendment or under the Due Process Clause. And speaking for myself, I think the law is very clear on that point. The act must be intentional. And there's no such, but that's not before us, is it? That wasn't raised in the trial court, and that isn't a grounds that you are citing here. You're not saying affirm for the different reason because it fails to state a claim under 12b-6, are you?
No, sir, Your Honor, but I do want to note that, as I said before, there is no allegation that the failure to release the warrant was intentional, and we did, ADA Stevenson did argue that the 1983 claim was stated insufficiently, and the district court did make that very general ruling, although the court did not go into negligence.
What about reckless conduct? Would that state a claim under the Fourth Amendment or due process?
Not in this instance, Your Honor. I don't believe so.
Well, you're saying as a matter of fact they couldn't show recklessness, but I'm asking a different question. Would recklessness state a claim for wrongful arrest under the Fourth Amendment or for a due process violation?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Your Honors. I just want to, on rebuttal, point out very quickly that two separate items, which is that Schneider v. Smith, I think, answers my esteemed colleague's questions about Odd v. Malone's application post-Goldstein. In that case, the Third Circuit analyzed the effect of Goldstein on its previous order and found that it was still good law based on the facts there. And Malone's case, as I've said before, is much more on point to ours than Schneider's, which was a more difficult case. Secondly, I just want to point out as well that Goldstein, in terms of an administrative claim having absolute immunity, was predicated on core prosecutorial acts. That's the real, I think, basis for that. The court was particularly alarmed by the idea that individual prosecutors could be granted absolute immunity, but their immediate supervisors, who are also prosecuting attorneys, would not be given that same immunity.
Let me ask you a question. To the extent we're looking at the character of the act itself in a generic sense rather than the state of mind of the actor, we're not interested in why she did what she did. We're interested in what it is that was done. What's the nature of the conduct itself? When we make this examination of absolute immunity, to the extent that the prosecutor has to go back to the judge who tried the case to seek the recall, isn't that part and parcel of the judicial kind of process, whatever the reason and however ministerial the act may be?
I think that when the courts have looked at the judicial process that they're seeking to protect, they're looking to protect the truth-finding or truth-seeking function of that process. At this point, when the criminal trial is over, that core function that the court was concerned about in Imbler and in Burns and beyond was no longer in effect. The idea that a prosecutor might be hesitant to put on a witness or to use evidence that they're not clear about the origins of which or the veracity of that evidence doesn't apply here. They've already used the evidence. They've already had the witness. All of that truth-seeking function that we seek to protect, according to Justice White and his concurrence in Imbler, has already passed.
Let me ask you just one hypothetical and tell me whether this would get absolute immunity or not. I know it's not our case. Prosecutor gets the warrant. Witness appears in a criminal trial. Case is decided. verdict rendered by jury, and at that point it becomes clear that there is a problem with the verdict. The jurors were animated by race bias. The district court, or the trial court's going to have to hold a hearing and find out what the facts are. Case is over. It might take weeks to unravel the problem. The prosecutor says, I'm not seeking a recall here. Let him sit in jail until we get this over, because I'm concerned that the case may go down, in which case the trial judge is going to retry the case a week later or shortly thereafter. If I were the prosecutor, I would be dead wrong on every level for making that decision. But I had made a calculus, a professional calculus, for whatever reason. Would I get immunity? So the guy is held for a period of weeks as the district judge or trial judge unravels whether race bias animated the jury's verdict and yielded a reversal. Motives are bad, but it's part of my prosecutor function, and I think I can keep the guy in jail till the retrial.
That certainly presents a more difficult case. In that particular instance, I'm afraid that my failure of knowledge of criminal procedure may not benefit me here, but I think we're looking at whether or not if there has to be a new trial or something along those lines, whether or not there's a significant connection to the judicial process at that point while this other activity is going forward, to permit the attorney, the district attorney, to express that, I guess, to be still in an advocate's role. Because we found that in advocating in MECO, in the 11th Circuit, we found that just because you're advocating about the control of a witness, if they don't have a current case with them, you're not, future trying a case, or it's not in your jurisdiction, that's going to be outside your advocacy.
Yeah, I appreciate the answer and your candor. The reason I raise the question is because now, as we get into this dialogue, we're focusing on the state of mind of the actor rather than the conduct itself. Maybe there's a good reason, maybe there's a bad reason. I'm just troubled by the fact that maybe we're slicing the salami too fine. Heads, they get absolute immunity. Tails, they don't. Even though in both instances, the prosecutor's got to go before the same judge and seek the recall of that which he obtained on the front end, whether for a good reason or a bad reason. Your answer is it's easy because there's no judgment involved at all in the ministerial act upon the completion of the trial as a general rule, and if we have this rare case, we can handle it separately. I take it that's the response.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Our next case is number